Warren Buffett, BlackRock, and other institutional players dominate investments in commercial aviation. Why? Because it's one of the most profitable and predictable alternative assets that exists. And it's not tied to other markets, such as real estate and the stock market. Is it safe? Well, imagine triple net leases to the likes of American Airlines and British Airways. Income is contractual and guaranteed by some of the biggest named airlines in the world. That's why this kind of investment was never available to the ordinary accredited investor. That is until now. Visit accesswealthaviation.com and check it out for yourself. Invest in an institutional team with over 200 plus years of combined investment experience in the aviation sector. Conservative investing with double-digit returns and tax advantages. That's accesswealthaviation.com. accesswealthaviation.com.
You are listening to the Wealth Formula Podcast with Buck Joffrey. Get ready to change your life.
Welcome, everybody. This is Buck Joffrey with the Wealth Formula Podcast, coming to you from Montecito, California, on the Central Coast here. And before we begin our show today, I want to remind you that there's lots of different things to explore, resources associated with the Wealth Formula Podcast at wealthformula.com. So if you're only listening to the podcast, you haven't visited the site, you're missing out, because there are things to download, free books, videos, webinars, things like that. Also, it's a place where you go to sign up for some of our lists. For example, if you are an accredited investor and you are interested in participating in some deal flow and getting off the sidelines and using some of this information that we have, go to wealthformula.com and sign up for our investor club. Also, there is a group, a private group called Wealth Formula Network. Wealth Formula Network is essentially our online community. Starts with a course. The course is really good. Bunch of familiar names on there like Tom Wheelwright and Kenny McElroy. You learn a lot of the basics, and then it moves into our community, where we are very interactive on the Facebook page, but probably more importantly, in our biweekly Zoom conference calls, which are very, I'm just so impressed at the level of conversation in those. I feel like I learn something every day that we do those. So check that out. That's at wealthformularoadmap.com. Avoid the, ignore the silly video sales thing. It was written by some internet marketer, and you know, whatever. You guys don't need that. You get the point. Anyway, again, wealthformularoadmap.com. Today, we are going to do yet another episode of Ask Buck. We try to do these quarterly, and well, I think the quarter is just about up, and it's time to get on the ball again. And so we've got a lot of interesting questions, so we're probably going to end up with more than one show. We'll probably end up with multiple Ask Buck episodes for this quarter. But you know what? This stuff is, I think, some of the more valuable information for, especially for people who are relatively new to the Wealth Formula ecosystem, because we go through a lot of basics, and then we define a lot of things that we sort of take for granted on the show. And so make sure to listen this week. Even there's just some really good questions. And so we will get to those right after these messages.
Worried about saving too little too late for retirement? The Wealth Accelerator may be exactly what you need. With the help of some of the oldest and most reliable insurance companies in the country, Wealth Accelerator allows you to take most of the upside of any good year in the stock market and use bank loans to magnify those returns significantly. And what if the stock market has a bad year? No need to fear. Wealth Accelerator is engineered so you don't participate in the losses of the market, no matter how bad of a year it is. Sounds too good to be true, right? But it's not. It's simply the same financial engineering that the ultra wealthy have been doing for years. Now it's your turn. Check it out for yourself by going to wealthformulabanking.com. Again, that's wealthformulabanking.com.
Self-storage is a necessary evil. It's where you keep your stuff and forget about it. No wonder this stuff is so profitable and recession-resistant.
The Wealth Formula community, well, we've benefited from that. We've made lots of money in this space with Reliant Real Estate, one of the largest self-storage companies in the country. With an average investor internal rate of return of almost 34%, with hold times just over 3.5 years, these guys know what the meaning of velocity of money is. If you're an accredited investor, make sure to check out what they're up to right now at ReliantFund4.com. Again, that's ReliantFund4.com.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. I am here myself without a guest today because I am doing an episode of Ask Buck. So lots of really, really interesting questions. And I think it's an opportunity for us to learn together. And let me start, you know, this week I'm going to start, I prefer these questions that are recorded. So I'm going to do as many as we can within, you know, a reasonable amount of time and then move on to the rest of the next week. Let me start out with a question from George. George, here you go.
Hello, Buck. George from North Texas. I'm invested in two of your Western Wealth deals. A question about some legislation working its way through the House right now that I heard about that would make it illegal to use an IRA or self-directed IRA to invest in any private placement or single member LLC. And furthermore, would require anyone who has ever done so to liquidate that private placement investment within 2 years. Wondering, one, if you're aware of this, and two, whether that would affect our ability to participate in Western Wealth opportunities in the future or affect existing Western Wealth investments. Appreciate your thoughts on this, and thank you for your podcast. Bye.
George, great question. Yes, I am aware of the legislation. So first of all, let's start with this. Everything that we are seeing right now is legislation, right? It is not law, and we need to see what actually does become law. So that's first and foremost. You know, I'm going to start a lot of these questions with the same reminder, which is that I am not a CPA and I'm not a lawyer, so don't take any of this as legal or financial advice. You are right, though, in that if this law that is currently being proposed in its current form, if that were to happen, you would no longer be able to invest in private placements with your self-directed IRA. Effectively, it targets anything where there's a minimum investment and or requires you to be accredited. So effectively, I mean, that is pretty much everything that is a private placement in any sort of way. So yeah, absolutely, that is a concern. As for, you know, current investments that you already have deployed, right now the legislation says that you would have to have that liquidated by 2024. And as you might imagine, that's not a lot of time for liquidation to occur in the type of stuff that we do. Now, I will say that I have to imagine there will be a way for people not to be penalized for lack of liquidation in this. I can't imagine that there would be, you know, no way to deal with that kind of stuff. So we'll see what the law says. You know what? This is round one, and who knows where it ends up by the end. It could be dropped off completely. And if it doesn't, well, there are some potential workarounds, which we're not going to get into today. But, you know, things that involve selling your shares, you know, also there's also ways to get valuations on those and potentially, you know, sell them from your IRA to, you know, someone else or maybe yourself or whatever. But we're not going to talk about that so much right now because it is so early and we don't really know where the law is going to end up. The bigger question is, you know, does this bill pass? And the thing is, a lot of times you look at this stuff and you think, well, you know what? That's just posturing for negotiations because that's asking for way too much and there's no way that's going to get through. But this one is a little bit tricky, I have to tell you. And the reason is, if you think about it, who benefits from this law? Who benefits from this going through? Because, I mean, it's so strange, right? Why would you not be able to control your own money? I mean, why does anybody care about that? And why should the government have a hand in that? These are all very good questions, but if you look at who would ultimately benefit from your inability to self-direct, it's Wall Street, right? Because effectively, it creates a situation where, you know, if you can't invest into alternatives, as they call them, then you're going to have to invest into the publicly traded markets and buy equities and bonds, and that dumps in more and more money into Wall Street. So the point of me bringing all this up is that, you know, a lot of times I'm like, well, you know, we'll see where it goes. And I'm not too worried about that because there's going to be a lot of, you know, political lobbyists and stuff who will probably get in the way. But the lobbyists here are probably on the side of Wall Street. And that's what worries me about it. Now, one thing I should point out, which was pointed out in our Wealth Formula Network group by one of our esteemed members there, which I thought was very important, is that right now the self-directed IRAs are specifically the target. The legislation does not refer to solo 401ks, you know, these things, QRPs or, you know, whatever you want to call them. And so they are not currently affected by this legislation as it stands. So, you know, those of you who are using solo 401ks would theoretically not be affected. And, you know, there's precedence for that. So if you look at, you know, laws regarding self-directed IRAs versus solo 401ks, they're different, right? If you have a solo 401k, you're not subject to the UDFI and UBIT and all that stuff. So they can have different rules. And I think you know, the 401ks being in the purview of corporate America might make a difference. And so I guess the question is, what do you do, right? And again, I'm not a CPA. I'm not going to give you any advice. But if it were me, and I don't have an IRA or a 401k, but if I had an IRA, I'd be trying to figure out right now that how could I, if I needed to, convert my self-directed IRA into a solo 401k, how could I do that? And there's plenty of options out there that people talk about all the time. And just to be clear, I'm not saying to do that, but it's something that you may want to do a little research on. From my understanding, again, my little knowledge in this area is that if you have a self-directed IRA, if it's not a Roth conversion already, that it's actually not terribly difficult to get into a type of solo 401k model. Look into it. But finally, again, I would just say also, beyond the fact that this is not tax and legal advice, I wouldn't panic just yet. There's a lot of scary stuff in this legislation. It's going to need to be ironed out. We just need to see what actually comes to fruition. All right. But good question, though. Next question is from Jason.
Hey, Buck. I have a single family rental home that I was thinking about selling and taking the proceeds and putting into a passive multifamily. The question I had is, can I do that in a 1031 exchange, or should I just sell it and pay the taxes before a potential multifamily investment? And then third, I was also thinking about just refinancing and increasing my cash flow and hanging on for the long haul. Just wanted to get your thoughts. A lot of moving parts, but appreciate the help. Thank you.
Great question again, Jason. As far as the, you know, the whole refi option, obviously it's a personal preference. If you like the asset, keep it. Refi, that's certainly not a bad way to go. But right now, as far as, you know, the 1031 exchange issue, the good news is we still have this benefit right now of 100% bonus depreciation. So when you put together these cost segregation analysis along with bonus depreciation, it actually sometimes be pretty clear that you don't really need the 1031. Again, reminding you that I'm not a CPA or a lawyer or financial advisor. Let's just do a little case study, though, because I think that's pretty kosher for me to do. So let's say you bought a house and it was a $100,000 house. And, you know, you did what you normally would do. Hopefully you do. You take some depreciation on that. Say you took $20,000 in the depreciation so far. So your basis is now $80,000. And upon sale, you would be responsible for the not only the capital gains, but the recapture of depreciation. Now, recapture is typically at a tax rate of 25%. So on that $20,000 of recapture, $20,000 of basis that you took in depreciation, you would have to pay, you know, about $5,000 in recapture. Now, you sell the house and say you sold it for $150,000. Nice profit, right? So you have $50,000 of capital gains too. So if you do nothing else, you would have that $50,000 of capital gains that you'd have to pay on. And then you would have, and so that's a, you know, at a cap gains rate of 20%, right? At a tax rate of 20%, you'd owe about $10,000. So you got that $10,000 of capital gains tax. And then the recapture we calculated came out to about $5,000. So with recapture and capital gains, you'd have about $15,000 of taxes to pay if you did nothing else. Okay. So, you know, obviously the traditional thing in real estate is to do a 1031 exchange, like exchange. You don't pay anything. And, you know, we go off into the sunset and keep doing that until you die. And then there's a reset of basis. But now, let's say, okay, you can't do a 1031 and you want to do a limited partnership and that kind of thing. So let's say instead of doing nothing and just eating the tax, you put that capital gains and principal in total $150,000, right? The $100,000 from before, the $50,000 of profit back into a limited partnership in multifamily real estate. Now, let's be conservative, and this is just based on what we've, you know, seen within our group. Let's say that you get 70% depreciation from that investment because of the cost segregation and bonus depreciation. So that's been, you know, my experience has been that that's been anywhere from 70% all the way up to 100%. But let's use 70% there. So you invested your $150,000 and you got 70% depreciation. You get a K-1 and that shows a loss now because of that 70% of $105,000. Now, guess what? Your total capital gains and recapture was only $25,000. So in this example, any gains you would have would be offset by depreciation losses from your investment into your limited partnership investment. And you'd have, you know, still some suspended losses that you could still use for other stuff. But again, you know, I'm not a CPA and all I'm doing is running the numbers on a theoretical example. So depending on your depreciation and gains and, you know, leverage certainly plays a part in this. The numbers could vary and you could certainly you certainly want to consult with your tax professional on this matter as well. But you know what? Run the numbers, right? And use, you know, just as simple modeling. And I think you get a pretty good idea. But the bottom line is that at least while we have 100% bonus depreciation that we can take on our cost segregation analyses, selling something and investing looks like it could be as good an option as, or even better than a 1031 exchange. All right, let's see. Let's get on to the next question. It's from Jimmy.
Hi, Buck. Just got a quick question for you regarding routines. Do you practice any particular daily routines that are intended to put you in an optimal mental, physical, or emotional state? I'm thinking, for example, like Hal Elrod's Miracle Morning routine that Robert Kiyosaki has talked about that, you know, has elements of meditation, affirmation and visualization, exercise, reading, journaling, or anything sort of in this category. Is that something that you do on a daily basis? And if you do that sort of stuff, do you get up early? Are you an early riser? Are you more like a night owl, somewhere between? thanks for your time and all you do to share your knowledge with us, Buck.
Jimmy, well, I'm definitely not a night owl. I tend to turn into a pumpkin at about 10 o'clock at the latest. So, and also, you know, although I wish I could say I did do something special, I don't do anything like the Hal Elrod Miracle Morning. But like you said, you know, I know a lot of people swear by it. I know Robert Kiyosaki told me he does it himself. So I think there's probably something to it. I do think that routine is important, but being, you know, in my case, a single dad with kids half the time, it hasn't certainly been something that I've been able to implement very well, especially as of recent year or two here. But I do wake up early. I mean, I generally wake up at 7 a.m. at the latest, and my six-year-old will sometimes wake me up at 5 a.m., so I guess you will, you know, sometimes make me more productive in that regard. You know, I work out with personal trainers 3 times a week. I do this thing called the Genius of Flexibility. It's kind of a little culty type thing, but it's interesting. I've got like 3 trainers kind of, and it's resistance and you know, flexibility training and a lot of strength training and stuff. It's pretty cool. I used to hike several times per week, and I think that that's been very useful for me, especially over the pandemic. I'm sort of burned out on that. I have a lot more, you know, weird routines with my diet and stuff now. I mean, I do intermittent fasting, and that's based in, you know, the health things that are coming out about intermittent fasting. What is intermittent fasting? Well, basically, I usually eat only for about a window of about 6 hours in a day. Sometimes it's as little, frankly, as like 3 or 4 hours. And that's, you know, that seems to have some benefits in terms of weight loss and energy and things like that. I also take a lot of supplements. I've become like a crazy, you know, supplement guy. But a couple ones that I think I would highlight here are ones that are in some of the longevity studies that are out there. NMR, which increases NAD levels. I take a lot of vitamin D. By the way, if you've never gotten your vitamin D levels checked, have them checked out, because everybody seems to have low vitamin D. And vitamin D actually does quite a bit for your energy levels if it's not normal. So mine was kind of really low. And so I started taking it. I noticed a big difference from that. And then there's also a supplement called spermidine. Now, that's a terrible name, I know. And it doesn't do what you'd think it would do. It's actually another supplement that's in the top, in the longevity literature. And it's related to something called autophagy of senescent cells, which is basically like, you know, dead cells and stuff like that, getting rid of those quicker. You know, by the way, I think this book from David Sinclair, I think it's called Lifespan. It's a really good book. I highly recommend it. Very entertaining as well, especially if you're middle-aged like me and you're trying to figure out how to live longer and stuff like that. This guy's really smart. Harvard biologist, and he's doing great work over there, and I follow him on Twitter and stuff too. So check that out, Lifespan. Now, although I don't have a work routine, I will say that, you know, I think one of the things that differentiates me from a lot of people is that I am very, very good with time management. And honestly, like, I think that's one of the most critical things out there, is just being able to manage your time, however you do it. I mean, I honestly spend a lot of my time just working on my phone. See, I'm working from wherever I am during the day. And then, you know, I don't feel like it spills into any hours that I don't need it to spill into. Anyway, that's about all I got. I wish I had something that was more useful to the audience, but if you figure out something that works for you, let me know. But I can't really wake up any earlier and have much of a routine because of the single dad thing. Let's see. I think we have time for one more for this session. So let's go with a question from John Hurwitz.
Hi, Buck. This is John in Santa Rosa, California. I have a question about suspended passive losses and offsetting active income. I'm aware that normally this is not the case, unless you're a real estate professional, which I'm not. So I had banked quite a bit of suspended losses, like probably many other members of the group. My understanding and my question is, when an asset sells, and for example, there's a capital gain of $100,000 at that point, then the equal amount of suspended passive losses can then be released. And when they're released, my accountant tells me they can, at that point, offset active income. It's kind of like they go to their highest and best use, and instead of offsetting the capital gains from the sale, they offset active income, which is more tax beneficial to me. And then, of course, you still have to deal with the capital gains tax on the profit. But all things considered, the ability to use suspended passive losses at the time of a sale, having them be unreleased and then offset active income, I just want to get confirmation that is the case, because that is not talked about very much. Thank you for all you do, and thanks for taking the time with this question.
John, thanks for that question. Really, really good question. I got to say, we have like the smartest group. I mean, even these questions that we get are just so much better than what you get on other podcasts and stuff, in my opinion. But John, let me do this first. Let me review what you're talking about so that everybody's on the same page. And let me also, again, tell you this disclaimer. I'm not a CPA and I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a tax advisor. I'm not anything, just a guy with some opinions and who does little research myself. So what John's talking about, so one of the great advantages of real estate investing, especially these days because of cost segregation analysis and bonus depreciation combination, is there are significant paper losses, you know, vis-a-vis that depreciation that you can theoretically take advantage of. But one of the really important things to remember is that, you know, income's classified in various different buckets, right? It's either you got passive income, you've got active income, and then there's portfolio income, which is like stocks and bonds. Now, my understanding is that you can only use portfolio losses to offset portfolio gains. And similarly, you can only use passive losses to offset passive gains. So if you're not classified as a real estate professional, as John pointed out, you can't use real estate depreciation losses against your earned income from your job. So so many people who invest in real estate end up creating a whole wall of suspended depreciation losses that they really can't use to offset any passive gains. And they basically have to wait until there's, you know, passive income to offset, or there's a liquidation of one of those passive assets. So again, let's show a little model. So say you have $500,000 in suspended losses because you've been investing in all sorts of limited partnerships and they keep sending you K-1s and you can't use that against the earned income that you make. You're making, you know, a few hundred thousand dollars, $1 million a year, whatever. You can't use that $500,000 against that earned income. Now, all of a sudden, one of the investment properties that you have, it sells, and you have a $100,000 passive gain. Now, you should be able to offset those gains with the accrued losses that you have, all of those suspended losses. And we have called this phenomena the golden hamster wheel for this reason, right? It's like you just build up these walls of depreciation losses, and every time there's gains in income, you keep offsetting them and not having to pay taxes. Now, what John is asking is actually a fairly nuanced and complicated question. He's asking, if you have that $100,000 capital gains, do the suspended losses have to offset the capital gains specifically, like surgically, or could they or do they actually offset ordinary income for that year? Now, John, according to my CPA, because I'm not going to give you tax advice, you are correct. So the offset is not surgically target your capital gains. The ordinary income is always essentially offset first. So, and you are right, people don't talk about this much, but it is an additional perk of that, those depreciation losses that you have. So if you have $500,000 of ordinary income, and say all of a sudden you have $100,000 capital gain and you have suspended losses, to offset that $100,000 gain, you would pay ordinary income taxes on $400,000, not $500,000. So again, that is doing what you're saying. It is essentially offsetting your active income there. And then you would pay a capital gains rate on $100,000. Anyway, that is a very, very good question. It's one of those things that I think only this group come up with. So I appreciate that question, John. And hopefully my theoretical answer from a non-CPA, non-tax professional person like me is helpful. But yes, I concur based on what my CPA is telling me. Anyway, I think that's it for this week. We don't want to overdo it with questions in 1 week. So we'll just have some final comments right after these messages. Welcome back to the show, everyone. Hope you enjoyed that episode of Ask Buck. I'm going to leave you with a little bit of commentary here because I think, you know, we had an interesting conversation on Wealth Formula Network the other day about, you know, how do you get started and how do you create this plan and how do you feel confident about it if you're a newbie to this space? Here's the problem, right? The problem is that there's no silver bullet. By definition, what we are doing is talking about personal finance. And what we understand in the ethos of this show is that personal finance is very personal. And the problem with you going to a coach or a personal financial advisor or whatever, well, first of all, with personal financial advisors, the financial advisors rarely have, they're not going to give you advice that's based purely on, you know, the reality of things because they are driven by assets under management. Also, there's this issue that frankly, not all financial advisors who are used to dealing with stocks and bonds and all that kind of stuff are going to know much at all about, you know, about real estate and the things that come here. So what we're talking about is very different kind of investing that really is not familiar to everybody. Now, the problem with coaches, in my opinion, is that financial coaches usually wouldn't be coaching if they were wealthy because wealthy, super wealthy people don't have time to coach. It's, you know, one-on-one coaching, frankly, is not going to be terribly profitable, right? So that's another problem. So I'm not a big fan of the coaching type situations because I think one of the principles that's important to me is to not look for financial answers and advice from people who make a lot less money than me. I think that's it's a pretty good rule to live by. So then what do you do? Well, the reality is the whole thing is a big grind. The whole thing is a big grind, and all you can do is continue to educate yourself. I think these peer groups are very, very important. The peer groups are, you know, like Wealth Formula Network. I know Jim Pfeiffer and those guys also have Left Field Investors, and, you know, these groups are extraordinarily important. And what I would suggest is, you know, when you are starting out, to find some of these groups and really just take your plan out there. And, you know, start having people poke holes in it. Have your peers poke holes in it. That's the kind of group you want to find. So that would be what I would suggest, because I think a lot of people are in that situation, especially when they first get into this, alternative personal finance space. Anyway, that's it for me this week on Wealth Formula Podcast. Hopefully I will see many of you at the Dallas event. This is Buck Joffrey signing off.
Thank you for listening to the Wealth Formula Podcast. Visit us on the web at wealthformula.com. The information contained in this podcast are opinions, not fact. As always, consult your own financial team before making any investment. See you next time.
Buck Joffrey here from Sapio with Buck Joffrey. Aging might become reversible over the next 10 to 20 years. It's already being done in lab animals, so it's just a matter of time. Our challenge? To be healthy enough for when that time comes. As a former scientist and surgeon myself, my goal is to figure out how to do that and to share it with you. I wrote a book called Living Longer for Busy People that you can download for free at sapiopodcast.com. You'll be amazed at just how a few daily adjustments can add years of a healthy life for you. Again, download it for free, sapiopodcast.com.